Since the 1800s, Hickok & Boardman Insurance Group has been providing quality service and peace of mind to our clients. With our offices in Burlington, Stowe, and St. Albans, and our Dennis Ricker & Brown offices in Montpelier and Lynnonville, we are here when you need us.
And now WDEV FM and AM presents our two-hour public affairs program, Open Mic with Mike Smith. Important topics, topical guests, and your phone calls. And now here's the host of Open Mic, Mike Smith.
Good morning, everyone, and thank you for joining us today. On today's program, we have a number of guests scheduled just in the first hour. WCAX reporter Alex Apple will join us to talk about his recent article in Politico magazine entitled "Why a Republican Might Win Bernie's Home State." Then Aaron Mansfield, a reporter from Vermont Digger, will join us to explain what is going on with the all-payer waiver that the state now says they have a draft agreement with the federal government. And Paul Hines, political editor of 7 Days, will join us to review this week's political news. And that's just in the first hour. In the second hour, we'll check in with our colleagues at Talk Media News. And then it's the popular Free-for-All Friday. This is the Free-for-All Friday is about you calling in on any subject that you wish to bring up. That's what Free-for-All Friday is all about, calling in with those subjects that are on your mind. I'll start off with a few subjects that we talked about this week. But it's your program. That's what Free for All Friday is. But first up, I'd like to welcome to Open Mic. And on the phone line is Alex Apple, WCAX reporter. And we're going to be talking to him about his article in Politico magazine entitled "Why a Republican Might Win Bernie's Home State." Good morning, Alex.
Good morning, Mike. Happy Free for All Friday to you.
Thank you very much. Hey, the premise of your Politico magazine article is that there is a diverse electorate here in Vermont where they can support Bernie Sanders, but they might support a Republican for governor. Does that surprise people nationally?
Yes, of course, that's a national publication. So the underlying premise was what might be surprising to people nationally or what they might learn about Vermont. And obviously, in a primary where Bernie Sanders wins 87% of support nationally, you just look at that number and you think, wow, pretty liberal state, and such is Vermont's reputation anyway. But the underlying interesting nature of Vermont politics, call it eccentric if you want, I called it in the article a little more personality politics than proposal or policy politics, is that Vermonters generally like politicians that they know personally. They expect to meet candidates, and people really like Bernie Sanders here. They feel like he's fighting for them in Washington. That's why he's been reelected time and time again. But at the same time, and the anecdote I started the article with is, I have on several occasions seen a Bernie Sanders sign in a yard followed by a Phil Scott sign in a yard, something that would be a political oddity in other parts of the country. And so in the article, I tried to explain why, even in a year in which Bernie Sanders runs for president, thinks he's changed the course of the Democratic Party, gets people fired up around the country for democratic socialism, and is being used by the Democratic Party as a vehicle to fire up young people, in Vermont, he's beloved, but the state might go ahead and elect a Republican governor. And I think people nationally found that surprising.
In your article, you mentioned this, sort of the issues that have lined up to produce this possibility. What are some of those issues?
Well, I think it started out 7 years ago. I looked up and did a little budget math, and the top number is going to escape me, but more than $600 million the budget has risen here in Vermont, and that has created an increasing tax burden. You've seen over the last years the budget not lining up, and then lawmakers in Montpelier have got to come up with whatever amount of millions of dollars in order to make that line up and continue to balance the budget moving forward. And I think that started when the recession started. I mean, that's not a stretch to say the state started to rely on one-time federal money to run some of the programs that it wanted. And then you've got Peter Shumlin coming into office trying to institute Vermont Health Connect, the state's own health exchange, instead of going with the federal exchange for the Affordable Care Act. You had promises of a single-payer system that weren't quite delivered. And so I think as it was either you or Jason Gibbs that I interviewed in the article that said, you know, Vermonters are a little bit disappointed that some of the promises that were given to them weren't fulfilled. And on top of that, I think a lot of Vermonters feel a little bit of financial stress. And that's why there is this openness to a new direction. And perhaps some Vermonters think that Phil Scott opens that.
We're speaking with Alex Apple, a WCAX reporter, but he wrote a piece, a recent piece, in Politico magazine, Why a Republican Might Win Bernie's Home State. Even in your interview, in your article, even the head of the Democratic Party acknowledges the possibility of this sort of, I don't know, split personality in this state. Even the head of the Democratic Party recognized.
Yeah, and the key is, you know, I would have been remiss to not mention in the article that Vermont has a history of they go Democratic governor, then a Republican governor, then back to a Democrat, back to a Republican, one whenever that incumbent is no longer on the ballot. And that has been decades-long tradition. So Phil Scott's election would follow in that trend, and perhaps that's because Vermonters go through 6-8 years of one party's rule and then are ready for a change. The head of the Democratic Party, you're right, said something really interesting. You know, he framed it as it would be historical to elect Suventer. I don't think many people are framing the election in that way, but he said to elect two straight Democratic governors would be quite an accomplishment, and he said the biggest thing that Minter is facing is a name recognition gap. Phil Scott is very popular in this state, and he's popular with people regardless of what their politics are on a lot of levels. And so they feel like if they can bridge the name recognition gap, that Sue Minter is in a great place to buck the trend of Republican, Democrat, Republican, Democrat. And I thought it was interesting how he framed that would be historic for the Democratic Party to get two straight governors.
Often when you're writing something, I know in my case when I write the weekly column for the Times Argus and Rutland Herald, I discover something through that writing.
Yeah.
Did you discover something through this?
Yeah, I think what I discovered is that, and this came from a lot from the feedback, is that Vermont is misunderstood and its politics quite unique when you compare it to other places nationally or you compare it to other states. You know, I'm a Tennessee guy. It's where I grew up. I also live some in Texas. And now coming here and have seeing it so closely, having reported here for several years now, to see it so closely, it is unique in that people are so close to their politician. You know, I often give the example of there was a dirt pile in Letty Park in Burlington, and some of the people that live by Letty Park were not happy that there was a big pile of dirt sitting in the parking lot. Well, and they were upset, so they got the head of Parks and Rec out there. The mayor came out there. Local politicians, local reps were out there. In no other state can you get that kind of movement on something just because residents are upset about this dirt pile. And that is the willingness of Vermont politicians to come out to speak with the citizens and to really have the citizen legislature. You know, that might be a corny old saying, but Vermont embodies it closer than a lot of states, and I think that's why Vermont's unique in that people vote for the people that they like. A lot of times, party doesn't matter. And you compare that to other parts of the country. Had Bernie Sanders been from, let's say California, I don't think you would have seen many Bernie Sanders signs coupled with a Phil Scott sign right next to it, a Democratic Socialist and a Republican. And that's what I learned, is that I thought Vermont politics were unique, and I feel like the article confirmed that for me.
I have reaction to what I say on the air every day through emails. I have reaction for what I write every week through emails. What's been the reaction from your article?
I think people were surprised to learn what Vermont's political reality is like. The Republican Governors Association sent the article out in a mass mailer to everyone on their list. You know, hey, look, a Republican can win Bernie Sanders' home state. I'm sure they had reason to feel good about that. But the reaction has been one of a lot of intrigue, that people do like Bernie Sanders' policies. Some of his policies now, if you apply them to Vermont, I feel like people are looking at the amount of money the state has and they say, hey, I don't know how we're going to pay for that, or I don't know whether we're going to be able to pay for that. And so perhaps that's why they're open to Phil Scott. On the other hand, you say anything critical of Bernie and people, the Bernie supporters will certainly come out and back him up. And I didn't think the article was critical of him, but rather speaking to a political reality in Vermont. But on one hand, I'm sure the Republican Governors Association loved it, and I'm sure Bernie Sanders wishes that his state would get behind a list of Democratic Socialist candidates or progressive candidates and just vote them all into office. But in Vermont, the political reality is somewhere in between.
Alex, I got a few more minutes. We see you as a reporter on WCEX. You've written for Politico. You used to be a writer for the Dallas Morning News. And you recently participated in a reality TV show. What what reality TV show are you going to be on or on?
I am still not at liberty to say. I would imagine you might find out in the next couple of months. I'll give you a sneak peek. The show is supposed to air in January. It was a survival experience and one that was quite interesting. I would love to come on the show and share with you about it here pretty soon. But just given the rules of how they like to do things, I'll let the show have its thunder first when they announce that stuff, and then I'd love to come on and talk about it because it was quite an experience. I will certainly not be one that I will soon forget.
Well, Alex, we will have you on. Plus, we'll have you on about other stuff with Vermont politics and Vermont
Absolutely.
Stories. So, Alex, thank you very much for being with us today.
As always, a pleasure, Mike.
That's Alex Apple, WCEX reporter. Coming up, Aaron Mansfield, Vermont Digger reporter. We'll be talking about the all-payer waiver. What does that mean to you? This is Open Mic. Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith. It's my pleasure to have on the line Aaron Mansfield, Vermont Digger reporter, and we're going to be talking about the all-payer waiver. Good morning, Aaron. Good morning, Aaron. Let's just review for a moment for the audience. What is the all-payer waiver, and what does it allow the state to do?
Yes. So the all-payer waiver is a term that often refers to a contract between the state and the federal government to change certain rules in Medicare and other health care law. You might have heard the term global commitment waiver. Actually, you.
Hey, Aaron, we're going to
pull about that.
Aaron, we're you're breaking up on us here. Can you sort of move your location a little bit and see if that works?
Yes.
Step to the right about 8 steps and see if that works.
How is this?
Well, let's give it a try. Let's try it again. The all-payer waiver. What is it, and how does it impact us? Well, Aaron may have stepped over a cliff when we told her to go and do this. Aaron, why don't you do this? Why don't you call us back, and we'll talk about the all-payer waiver and what it does for Vermont. I just want to give you a heads up in terms of what's coming up on the program today. We're going to be speaking with Aaron Mansfield when she calls back from Vermont Digger. We had a bad connection, and we're going to try to work that out. Secondly, Paul Hines will be coming up. Paul is the political editor of 7 Days magazine, and we want to talk about topics that have happened in state politics this week. There was a debate in Rutland. There was a replacement announced, or a process for a replacement announced, for Justice Dooley, who was going to be retiring in March. And the Milne and Leahy debates, Zuckerman and Brock on race. They've had a disagreement over race, and Minter moving the goalpost in terms of what she is now demanding of Phil Scott's company. Let's get back to Aaron Mansfield, and let's get back to the all-payer waiver. Aaron, let's try starting again here. Let's just review the all-payer waiver. What is it? Well, that's not going to work here. So let's skip this segment, Tom. It's just not going to work with the connection that we have. And I'll preview what is coming up and shoot out a few things here that's been going on in the world. So let's start with what's coming up. We're going to be speaking with Paul Hines, political editor of 7 Days. He'll be calling in, and it will be a review of the week of the politics, the debate in Rutland, the fact that Governor Shumlin is going to appoint a Supreme Court justice to replace Justice Dooley, who is retiring in March. Now, the controversy is that he is retiring at the last part of March, actually the last day in March. And what that means is that it will be almost 3 months after the governor has left office. We'll talk about Milne and Leahy and where we are with debates, where we are with various things, Zuckerman and Brock on race, Minter moving the goalposts. This is an interesting story because the Democrats were all over Phil Scott in terms of he divesting himself completely from his company. He has agreed to do that, to sell his share of the company. That's what the Democrats wanted. Sue Minter now has moved the goalpost on that and says, no, Du Bois can't even bid for state contracts because, guess what? There's relatives related to Phil Scott. That kind of goes too far in terms of relatives being involved in a company and you can't bid on state contracts. The state airplane. We had a lot of calls yesterday on the state airplane. It is either a 172 Cessna or a 182 Cessna. It's a four-seat Cessna. It is 52 years old. The governor wants a new airplane so that it can cart the future governors around around the state, and also, you know, also do other things for state government. We'll talk with Paul Hines about Winooski and the Rutland Syrian refugees. All that will be coming up when Paul Hines calls in, and after we talk with our friends at Talk Media News about the various political issues. And there's a lot of political issues going on in the world right now. One of them is, you know, some lawmakers are having remorse over a veto override that they just did yesterday on the 9/11, allowing 9/11 victims to sue the Saudi government and maybe gather assets from the Saudis that are here in the United States. We'll ask our friends at Talk Media News about Wells Fargo and how the CEO and president did before Congress yesterday. I'm going to tell you, it wasn't very pretty. And there's a Cuba story out there that Donald Trump has been explored business opportunities in the 1990s that violated sort of the Cuba embargo. And then Trump says he is going to start highlighting or mentioning Bill Clinton's infidelities. Is that fair game? We'll ask our friends at Talk Media News. And the president is in Israel today. We'll talk about that. And then it's Free for All Friday. It's about anything that you want to talk about, any issue that's on your mind. We'll do this. This is a very popular segment with our listeners, with you. And I think there's a lot to talk about in the world, in the state, particularly in the state. And I'll just start off Free for All Friday with some issues we've been discussing during the week. But guess what? Free for All Friday is anything that you want to talk about. So in the second hour, we will have Free for All Friday for about 45 minutes. So we're going to take a break. When we come back, Paul Hines, political editor of 7 Days, and we'll review the week in state politics. This is Open Mic. Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith. It's my pleasure to welcome to Open Mic Paul Hines, political editor of 7 Days. Good morning, Paul.
Good morning, Mike. How are you?
I am fine, thank you. The debate in Rutland, the two candidates, Sue Minter and Phil Scott, met in Rutland this week. What did we glean from that?
Well, it's a pretty interesting debate. I think probably the best one yet, in part because your predecessor, Mark Johnson, had great questions, great follow-ups, and I think he got a lot out of these candidates. The thing that struck me the most, and I haven't seen a lot of coverage of this, was the way that Sue Minter talked about Vermont Health Connect. Obviously, she's been asked about this a million times on the campaign trail. And in the past, when I've heard her speak about it, she's always said that she's going to fix Vermont Health Connect. But at the debate this week, she said she seemed to be backing away from that, kind of opening up a door to perhaps ditch Vermont Health Connect if that is what the independent assessment that's going on right now recommends. So she said, and I quote, "If I learn from the independent assessment that the legislature funded that there is a way to move, I will move. If I learn there's a way to complete and make the system functional, I will do that." So I thought that was really interesting. And I haven't really I haven't heard from her campaign since about it, so I don't really know whether that was intentional or not, but it definitely sounded like a different framing than I heard before.
Prior to the debate, it was announced that Rutland will be a Syrian refugee town or area. Was that brought up in the debate at all?
It sure was. First question out of the gate, and man, that was some good timing for V.T. Digger hosting a debate in Rutland on the day that this announcement came out. So this was a very interesting part as well, in part because Phil Scott has kind of weaved back and forth, I would say, on this issue. If you recall last fall, well before this application for resettlement in Rutland was announced, Phil Scott weighed in generally on the topic of refugee resettlement in the United States. And he first indicated that he had some safety concerns about that. He was really beat up by Matt Dunn, who was running for governor at the time. And he kind of backtracked a few days later, Phil Scott did, and said, "Well, I've learned more about it. I now feel like, this can be done safely." Then after the Rutland application was made and revealed, I want to say in April or May of this year, April, I think, he ended up getting to a place of supporting the application. But Bruce Lissman, his Republican primary opponent, really beat him up over that issue and sent some targeted mailings in Rutland saying, "I, Bruce Lissman, am the one who opposes refugee resettlement, and Phil Scott does not." So he's been kind of beat up both ways on it, and you could kind of hear that in his answer because he really sort of tried to have it both ways, I would say. He to the point that Mark Johnson had to go back at him and say, "Well, Are you in favor of this or not?" And he sort of landed on being supportive of this proposal, but with significant reservations.
It's interesting because this is a huge issue in the Rutland area. In fact, it is a huge political issue in the Rutland area. Phil Scott lost Rutland in the primary.
He did. And, I always want to be careful about attributing an outcome, geographically to a particular issue, but it is clear that Bruce Lissman hammered him in that area over resettlement. And in a Republican primary, that probably has some resonance, I would assume. Now, in a general election, it's hard to say how this will play. There's been a little bit of polling by Castleton, which indicates that people are supportive of refugee resettlement, but I don't think... I don't know if we know that for sure. Sue Minter was very clear in her position. She supports refugee resettlement and supports Rutland's application. And she's got a pretty good talking point because she can and does mention that her own family actually hosted a family of refugees in Waterbury several years ago. So she can speak in very personal terms about what that was like and the success that she says that family has found in Vermont. I think that probably works pretty well to a general statewide audience. In Vermont, I wonder if Phil Scott's answer might have played a little bit better.
One of the things that I was interested in is, and I don't know if this came up in the debate, but you can tell me, but Minter seems, and this is the headline of that you wrote, Minter seems to be moving the goalpost on this whole conflict of interest dealing with Phil Scott's company. The Democrats had said that the only way that Phil Scott could basically take away this conflict was for him to sell his portion of the company. Well, he has agreed to do that. But now Sue Minter is saying, look, because he has relatives in that company, well, there's still a conflict, and they shouldn't be bidding on state contracts. That's kind of moving the goalpost, isn't it?
Yeah, and I have to correct you. It was actually Terry Hollenbeck, my colleague, who wrote this story about Minter moving the goalposts on Phil Scott. But I couldn't agree more with her conclusion and with yours on this one. And this did come up in the debate. It was a pretty interesting exchange about this. You know, I think that the Democrats and Sue Minter had a pretty salient issue with this one initially. You know, we're in an era of distrust toward government, and we've seen some allegations of cronyism in the current administration. So for Democrats to be able to point to this construction business getting state contracts and what would happen if Phil Scott doesn't really distance himself from the company, I think that could have been really great fodder for television ads and for attacks. And you could tell that the Democratic Party was gearing up to make those attacks. But Phil Scott did a really smart thing. You know, it took him a while, but he eventually realized that this was just going to kill him. And so he announced last weekend that he was going to sell the business. And, you know, I think that the intellectually honest response to that from Democrats would be to say, well, great work. Thanks for doing that. Let's move on. But that's not what they're doing. They're trying to keep this alive. Maybe and Phil Scott said in the debate, and he may be right, that the Democrats probably already had some ads queued up, maybe some television ads already made on this one, and they want to keep it alive so they can hit them on it. But I would imagine Vermonters would have a hard time buying this one if they see the details. I mean, yes, he's worked with Don DuBois, his current partner, possibly former partner, if he sells the business, for many years, and this is his cousin. But I think the notion that, you know, not only can you not own a business, but no one in your family can own a business that contracts with the state. I think that's
probably and no one in your and no one in your extended family can.
Exactly. Yeah. And you know, listen, I'm the first one to call out conflicts of interest, and I do think that the state, you know, I've argued before the state should have stronger conflict of interest laws. But I think there's a difference between a business you own, you know, a business that your spouse owns, and one that's owned by, like, a distant cousin. I just think that gets to be a harder and harder sell.
There's a danger in politics sometimes that you overplay an issue and it has a backlash. This smells to me that this could be such an issue.
Yeah, I think that's probably true. And I think the other point that Phil Scott and the Republicans are raising, which I think is a valid one, is that the great irony that suddenly the Democratic candidate for governor is raising ethics reform as a key issue when the Democrats have controlled the governor's office and the legislature for the last 6 years, and they have done nothing to enhance the state's ethics laws. I mean, I've been covering this stuff. I've covered, you know, mini scandal after mini scandal here. And when it comes to campaign finance reform and ethics reform, the Democrats always kill these bills. It's not the Republicans. The Republicans haven't had any power. So there is definitely some irony here that suddenly the Democrats are the champions of this issue.
This past week, Governor Shumlin surprised many when he announced that he would select and appoint a replacement for retiring Vermont Supreme Court Justice John Dooley. Here's why it was a surprise. Justice Dooley will be retiring from the bench at the end, actually the last day of March, almost 3 months after Shumlin has left office. Has this raised some eyebrows?
It definitely has, and I'm sure you recall our conversation last week when I asked you what the thought was. And I didn't really know, and you were pretty confident that it would go to the next governor, and that made sense. I took a while. I had reached out to the governor's office the day that Dooley announced that he would be resigning, and it took the governor's office 5 days, I think, to get back to me. They were researching the issue, and they came to the conclusion that they think that he does have the power to appoint Dooley's successor. And certainly, if you look at the Vermont Constitution, he does. But the Senate also has the power to not confirm the pick. Now, in practice, that I don't think that has happened in recent memory, a Senate rejecting a gubernatorial appointee. But it, you know, I don't know how lawmakers will view this, whether they'll view it as pushing this through a little bit too quickly.
But why? Here's my question. And obviously, I was up late last night writing a column about this. But,
yeah.
But
oh, so you're really doing over this.
But here's my question: why put the state through all this drama when the simple solution would be to wait for the new governor to make the new appointment?
It's a good question. And Phil Scott's campaign and Phil Scott himself at the debate the other day are saying that Shumlin must think that Phil Scott's going to win. And so he feels like he needs to push this through so that it's not Mr. Scott who makes this appointment. Maybe that's it. Or maybe Shumlin just wants to, you know, wants to continue to influence the court. I don't know. It doesn't seem like there's a pressing need to make this appointment if Dooley is, in fact, going to continue serving until late March. You know, the other way to look at it is, Shumlin, it's not like Shumlin's running for re-election, so there's not really much damage you can do to his political reputation. And if this becomes an issue in the gubernatorial campaign, which I don't expect it to, but if it becomes an issue, perhaps that ends up helping Sue Minter, because people will, it could energize Democrats and liberals who would be concerned about, a Republican putting a nominee on the bench, especially with this news coming out about Phil Scott's former views on civil unions, which was another subject of that debate.
And his 16 years ago, he wrote a article about civil unions. What did he say?
Well, he wrote there's a good story in the Burlington Free Press the other day about some of the things that Phil Scott said and wrote during his initial 2000 race for the Senate. Hold on a second. I'm just trying to find the exact wording because I don't want to get it wrong. Let's see. So it was a letter to the editor, to the Times Argus, and he wrote, "It angers me that our state government feels the need to, quote, ramrod the gay rights law in one session under the false pretense of political correctness. Shame on them." And then the story quotes him at a debate, a candidate forum that fall, again back in 2000, saying, "It's not civil rights, it's special rights for a select group of people." Now, those were pretty mainstream views at the time, back in 2000. They are not mainstream views now, and I don't know how this will play out. You know, I don't know whether people will think, that was 16 years ago, lots of people have evolved on gay rights, including President Obama and Secretary Hillary Clinton. But it could have some resonance in an ad. You know, I mean, you could see a Democratic Governors Association ad running these quotes and portraying Phil Scott as against gay marriage and against civil unions, even though he voted for gay marriage back in 2009 or 2010. 2009 or 2010? 2009, I guess. So I don't know. What do you think?
Well, I think, you know, it is obviously, I think Phil Scott has a point. It's an older issue. We've, you know, the whole state has evolved, and the fact that he can point to that 2014 or, excuse me, that 2009 vote is something that he will point to, and I think probably he neutralizes this issue with that vote. I think. We'll see.
Mm-hmm. But, you know, campaign ads don't have to tell the whole story.
That's right. Let's turn to David Zuckerman and Randy Brock. They have decided – well, Randy Brock wrote an open letter to David Zuckerman because Randy Brock was upset with a fundraising event that David Zuckerman was having, and it was at a race relations event in the south end of Burlington. And you wrote about this. What did you find out?
Well, it was a fascinating issue, I thought. I wrote about it in my column this week, and it actually wasn't a fundraiser. What it was a basically a forum in which a number of people who David Zuckerman had met on the campaign trail gathered to speak on stage at Arts Riot about race, criminal justice reform, and about drug addiction. And there were politicians there. It was organized by the Zuckerman campaign. But this came together when a guy named Jamel Rogers approached Zuckerman about these issues, and they eventually decided they wanted to have a forum, broader discussion about it. And you can watch video of this event on Facebook, and it seems pretty interesting, pretty compelling. But Randy Brock, the Zuckerman's Republican opponent, really had a number of problems with the way that he said Zuckerman had exploited these issues of race for political benefit. And he criticized the words that Zuckerman used to promote this event. So in a video that was posted to Facebook before the event, Zuckerman said, quote, we're going to have music, we're going to have fun, we're also going to hear stories and experiences from individuals. And he said it was going to be a, quote, good time. Brock's letter wrote, combating racism requires leadership and maturity, not a political campaign rally with music, a cash bar, and the promise of a good time. People in America are dying, David. Do you think it's appropriate to pass out lawn signs and pamphlets with your name and campaign logo on them at an event billed to be a conversation about the reasons behind those tragic deaths? Now, what I thought was really interesting about this was that Randy Brock is himself African-American, but he has almost never spoken about race on the campaign trail. He's been in public life for about a dozen years, and he has been resistant to talk about these issues. He says that it's really he thinks it's irrelevant to his campaigns and to his politics. But he has very, very strongly held views about this and some really compelling personal experiences. He told me about he grew up in Philadelphia, and he remembers a childhood trip that he took to North Carolina in the 1950s, where he remembers trying to take a drink from a water fountain and was told by his mother that he couldn't drink from that water fountain. He had to drink from a different one, which was not as nice. And so, you know, Randy Brock speaks with tremendous authority on this subject, and for him to accuse David Zuckerman of insensitivity, I think it's pretty compelling.
You know, I don't usually give advice. Well, I do usually give advice to candidates, but if I was
giving a radio host,
if I was giving advice to David Zuckerman, I thought what Randy Brock said was profound. He said, I came of an age in this country at the height of the struggle for civil rights. I'd lived through Jim Crow and had felt personally the sharp pain of racism and segregation in a way that you will never know. My advice to David Zuckerman is do not get into a race discussion with Randy Brock, who's an African-American. So you won't win in that sort of situation. He needs to move on and do other things.
Well, yeah, and I mean, I think that there's something to be said for that, absolutely. And you need to be extraordinarily careful when you're talking about race in this country, especially at this moment, when it is such a divisive and important subject. But when I spoke to Jamel Rogers and a guy named Edwin Owusu, who also took part in the event, they're both African-American men on the younger side, and they said, well, actually, no, we think that these are issues we should be discussing. And they really praised David Zuckerman for talking about them. And they said, no respect to Randy Brock, but why isn't he holding events like this to talk about these matters? So they came to it differently. Now, they agreed that some of Zuckerman's language was not necessarily using the right words, but they seem to be arguing that Zuckerman's heart, at least, was in the right place. So I think it's a thorny issue. You know, I mean, taking race off the table might not be the appropriate move, but being very careful about your word choice and about the way you frame a debate is probably wise.
State airplane. I didn't think we would be discussing a state airplane, but we're going to be discussing a state airplane. The governor has been for years trying to get a new state airplane. I don't know whether it's a G4, Gulfstream, or what he's trying to get, but he's trying to get a new state airplane.
So it was a Beechcraft Baron?
Yes.
That was the original request. I don't know the first thing about airplanes. I just happen to have the article in front of me.
It's a nice airplane. Uh-huh. But right now the state has, I think, either a Cessna 172 or a 182, which is a single-engine, four-seated plane that is 52 years old. The governor is using it to commute on occasion from southern Vermont to Montpelier, because he is now living in southern Vermont. And this issue came up during a press conference dealing with all payer, but the issue came up because the governor is still pushing for a new airplane. Do we need a new airplane, and should we get it?
Well, I don't know that I'm qualified to weigh in on our aircraft choices in the state, but I find this issue just quite interesting. You know, this is, I think, the third round of stories we've seen on the subject of the state plane during Shumlin's time in office. If you recall, the first time it came up was when Shumlin made a request in the budget for this new airplane, which would cost, I think, $1.2 million.
That's what I remember.
I'm sorry, $1.6 million over a decade for this lease program, or lease-to-own program. And the problem initially was that he didn't apparently talked to Senator Dick Mazza about this plan. And, of course, Mazza is the chairman of the Senate Transportation Committee, and was none too pleased to find out that the governor was trying to buy this plane, because he didn't think it was necessary. Pretty soon it came out that Shumlin had made a number of trips to the plane, had started to use it quite frequently, and this was back in 2012, 2013. And in fact, Shumlin had used it to fly to a campaign event during his 2012 reelection, and his campaign had not reimbursed the state. It did reimburse the state once I started asking questions about it in February of 2013. It seems like if you look through the flight records, it looks like Shumlin sort of goes through phases of using the plane more, and then there's some blowback and uses it less. But he seems to be back into wanting to use it more now. And one of the things that came up at that press conference, I wasn't there, but my colleague Terry Hollenbeck reported back to me about it. And, you know, Shumlin was talking about the plane, too, and about how broken it is and how his security detail doesn't want him flying in it. He said that the door popped open on him in flight. This is something he said back in 2013 as well, but no one could corroborate that claim. So I don't know what to say about this one.
It sounds like a bear story to me.
It is. It's just such a classic Shumlin story. You know, there's something. I guess it reminds me of Icarus a little bit, flying a little too close to the sun with this airplane.
Mr. Danger. Let's talk about Milne and Leahy. Milne was on this program yesterday. It still refuses to talk whether he's going to support Donald Trump or not, but hammers away at Leahy, saying that Leahy is representative of the old ways of thinking, that you're influenced by money in D.C., and that shouldn't be the case. Leahy counters, and we got 3 minutes left, Leahy counters that Milne doesn't have any issues. The only issue he has is attacking Leahy. What's your take on this?
Well, I think that Leahy's right about that. I attended a press conference on Monday with Scott Milne. I haven't had a chance to write about it yet, but I and a couple of other reporters really pushed him on, can you name a single issue that doesn't have to do with Leahy, where you had some kind of viewpoint, some sort of proposal, if you were to be a senator? And he said he does not. You know, he said that there are some things like climate change and criminal justice reform, he said, that were important to him, but he couldn't actually name a proposal And that, you know, I can understand. I think that if you're a challenger, if you're going up against someone like Patrick Leahy, it does probably make political sense to make this a referendum on Leahy and not a choice between a Democrat and a Republican in a federal race. But I do think that there is a sort of a threshold question here. You need to have some a couple of ideas you can pull out of your back pocket and say, these are things that I stand for. These are things I would do in the Senate, not just Leahy's bad, Leahy's bad.
Paul, I got to interrupt you there because, and we got to stop because we're starting to run out of time here. I do appreciate you calling it early.
Sure.
I really do. And thank you for your time. Great sort of end of the week sort of review of political events in Vermont. And thank you.
Absolutely. And have that state plane come pick me up for my commute. Okay?
I will. Paul Hines, political editor of 7 Days, coming up, Talk Media News, and then Free for All Friday. It's all, the program's yours. You call in on subjects that are of interest to you. This is Open Mic, and you are listening to locally owned and operated WDEV News Radio. I'm the Friendly Pioneer, celebrating its 85th year anniversary this year. That's right, celebrating the future. 85 years WDEV News Radio. WDEV AM 550 broadcasting from Waterbury and Montpelier. 96.1 FM from Warren. 96.5 FM from Barrie. 98.3 FM from Montpelier. And serving the kingdom at 101.9 FM from Island Pond. And of course, we're streaming worldwide at WDEVradio.com. If you want to listen to the Open Mic program at your convenience, at your time, just go on to WDEVradio.com and click on the Open Mic podcast. I'm Mike Smith. We'll be back in a moment. Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith. Before we turn our attention to national issues with Ellen Ratner, our colleague at Talk Media News, I just want to give you a heads up. Bill McKibben will be on Democracy Now! tonight with Amy Goodman, and he'll be on Open Mic on October 11th. And also coming up, Free for All Friday with your phone calls. But let's turn our attention to national issues and Ellen Ratner from Talk Media News. Good morning, Ellen.
And international issues. What's really fascinating, Bill Clinton just left Israel about an hour ago, and he had President Clinton as well as Secretary Kerry in tow with him. They were seen, that is, President Clinton and Secretary Kerry, talking on the tarmac before Air Force One left. Don't know what they talked about, but I'm sure they'll have more conversations on the plane back and perhaps with the president. That's going on today. Also, Mahmoud Abbas from Palestine did attend the funeral, and Egypt and Jordan sent representatives, though not the head of state, to the funeral. Other Arab countries did not because they don't have a peace agreement with Israel. Now, on the home front, as you know, Donald Trump is weighing whether to attack Hillary Clinton for her support of her husband Bill Clinton during the quote-unquote bimbo eruptions. That's what they used to call them in the 90s. And so the problem is that a Republican pollster, Frank Luntz, said that basically every time Trump moves in that direction with the undecided voters, they vote for Hillary Clinton. So it's not a pretty situation. And if I were Trump, I would hit her on issues, of which there are plenty, and I would stay away from that particular issue totally.
Got a couple of questions, Ellen. It was reported today that some lawmakers have buyer's remorse. I think that was the White House's phrase, buyer's remorse over the 9/11 veto override. And now there is some suggestions that there'll be new legislation quickly crafted to sort of limit what they did yesterday on the override. Are you hearing the same thing?
Well, yes. However, if you really read the bill, in my view, is just a political ploy. It allows the Attorney General of the United States to, in 120-day increments, to stop any court documents or to stop any legal what's it called? You know, I'm having a senior moment. But anyway, to stop any court cases against the Saudi government in 120-day increments indefinitely. So it really is, in my view, it was a feel-good piece of legislation. Go home, we vetoed the president, you know, we stopped his veto, et cetera, et cetera. I just think, and also, even if they were to win in court, it doesn't mean they're going to ever collect any money from the Saudi government.
Yesterday, Wells Fargo CEO and President Stumpf appeared before the House committee a week ago.
That's right. So originally last week it was a Senate committee when Elizabeth Warren took this guy apart limb by limb. Yesterday he announced that he's not going to be taking his non-invested stock options, which are in $30-40 million with that M dollars. But this is fascinating about this because, in fact, he may have done this, but he's still worth millions of dollars. And in asked whether he was going to continue as CEO, he said that's up to the board. But they really hung him out to dry by having him testify before both the Senate and House.
I mean, he got hammered in the Senate, and he got hammered in the House. What happens now? I mean, it seems to me the board has got to get rid of him, don't they?
Well, they may get rid of him. They may give him more of a golden parachute again. It's hard to say. I mean, you've got to have some pretty strong cojones, as they say, to be able to testify both before the Senate and House under withering questions from both sides. And what was fascinating about this is, you know, we don't think that people can get along, but they actually managed to get along very, very well, both sides here.
Well, they had a mutual person they could hammer. That's why. There's a story out about Trump exploring business opportunities in the 1990s in Cuba, and the story says that he violated the embargo provisions of the federal government when he did that.
In those days, and this was a Newsweek story that they released at 6 a.m. yesterday, in those days, basically what you had to do was you had to get permission from the U.S. government in order to even negotiate future deals if the embargo was lifted. If you spent any money in Cuba, you had to get permission or you had to go with a study group or one of those, which he did not do. It wasn't a lot of money. It means a lot of money to you and me, but to Trump it wasn't. It was $68,000 or $64,000. But he did not get permission and before he went or before his folks went. And that is a big problem as far as the U.S. government is concerned. And this was uncovered by Newsweek.
But is this a big political problem for him? It doesn't seem to be from our perspective here.
The Trump people are going to vote for Trump no matter what. The Hillary people are going to vote for Hillary no matter what. As I said, you know, a third of the people vote Republican. They don't care who's the nominee. A third of the people vote for Democrats. They don't care who's the nominee. It's that third in the middle that each side has got to worry about.
Let's switch to somebody we haven't talked about, which is Gary Johnson. Can Gary Johnson survive another senior moment?
I don't think he can. And, you know, it's interesting. Last night I was talking to a state official in New Mexico who said that Gary Johnson did not do a great job as the governor of New Mexico, that they think that it is not so much a senior moment as that he likes to smoke pot. I don't know what the truth is. But I know that he's had two senior moments, one on Aleppo and the other to name a world leader. I mean, I would have named Angela Merkel. It's not difficult.
Right. I mean, there are.
Could have named George Bush, you know, if he wanted to.
One of the things that I'm surprised about on that ticket, it would seem to me that they would flip that ticket with Bill Welch on the top and Gary Johnson as vice president.
That's what I think. I think Bill Welch should have absolutely been on the top. I know Bill Welch. I've interviewed Gary Johnson. I would go with Bill Weld any day of the week.
Former Massachusetts Governor Bill Weld obviously is a New York City lobbyist, New York City in a big law firm right now, but is running for...
He moved to New York. Remember, he wanted to be governor of New York State. He thought it'd be cool to be governor of two different states. Didn't make it.
Secretary of Homeland Security is saying, watch out for the elections. There could be hackers.
Well, I think they're very worried about hackers, and frankly, we should be. Hackers have gotten into our government files. I don't think our government files are as secure as we would like them to be.
Ellen, as always, thank you.
Thank you.
And have a great weekend.
You too.
That's Ellen Ratner from Talk Media News. And again, I just want to remind you that Bill McKibben will be on Democracy Now! Tonight with Amy Goodman and on Open Mic on October 11th. Coming up, guess what? Free for All Friday. This is Open Mic. Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith. It's Free for All Friday. Your phone calls on any subject that you want to talk about. Give us a call at 802-244-1777 or toll free at 877-291-8255. This is a segment where you call in and discuss the issues that are important to you. Now, I'll throw out a couple of some of the issues we talked about this week that generated a lot of phone calls. The first is, we spoke with Paul Heintz about this, was that Governor Peter Shumlin surprised a lot of people when he announced that he would appoint and he would select and appoint a replacement for retiring Supreme Court Justice John Dooley. And the reason it's a surprise? Well, John Dooley will not be retiring until the last day in March. And that's almost 3 months after Shumlin has left office. So many are asking, why do this? Why would you do this given that the governor, the new governor, will be in place in January, and there will be plenty of time left in order to make this appointment? You know, most had assumed, and I think rightly assumed, that this appointment would be left for the next governor when he or she takes place in January. Remember, we're almost only about a month away from this election. And it's not unusual for future decisions to be held over for the incoming governor, especially when there are things like appointments or events which really aren't imminent. Look, there are decisions that are urgent and need the attention of the current governor. After all, that's still his job. But the incoming governor makes some important decisions, too. For example, the job of the budget. We talked about this yesterday. Of crafting a state budget for the next fiscal year becomes the immediate responsibility of the governor-elect. And even though the current governor has been working on that budget for months, it is the governor-elect assumes those responsibilities right after, almost the day after election. Now, Governor Shumlin says he has the legal authority to replace Dooley, although probably there's going to be varying opinions with regard to this authority. So the question is, among many, even if Shumlin has the legal right to make such an appointment, should he? Why the rush to make the appointment now? It's open. It's Free for All Friday. Your calls on any subject. I'm throwing out some of the stuff that we discussed this week, but we don't have to discuss this. We'll discuss anything that's on your mind. Give us a call at 802-244-1777 or toll free at 877-291-8255. Let's go to Rama in Williamstown. Rama, you're on Open Mic. Good morning.
Good morning, Mike. Hey, listen, Shumlin with the replacement for Dooley. From what I've heard, not from what I've read, but from what I've heard from people who know these things, is that he not only has the authority, he actually has the obligation to begin the process now that Dooley has announced his decision to retire. But even if he didn't have the obligation to and he just had the authority as governor, he is still governor. And, this is the same argument we had down in D.C. with President Obama in appointing a new Supreme Court justice. It's at what point before the end of a government executive's at the end, at what point do they stop being whatever they are? At what point did President Obama stop being the president? At what point does Governor Shumlin stop being the governor? And it's not until they actually leave office. So, you know, this is kind of this is a really ginned up one. This is Governor Shumlin beginning the process like he should, and he is still governor. And if he wants to make an impact on the Vermont Supreme Court, that's his authority and that's his legal right as governor. I don't see what the problem is, and I don't see why people are acting like something bad is going on.
Rama, here's the problem with the analogy that you're making, and it is a problem with the analogy you're making. You're contending that Shumlin's decision to appoint Justice Dooley's replacement is similar to the Republicans in the U.S. Senate stonewalling President Obama's attempt to appoint a U.S. Supreme Court justice before the president leaves office. But there's a fundamental difference here between these two situations. And let me explain what those differences are. There's a vacancy on the U.S. Supreme Court because of the sudden death of Justice Anthony Scalia, whereas there's no vacancy on the Vermont Supreme Court until the last day in March when Dooley retires. This leaves the incoming governor with plenty of time to select and appoint a justice before a vacancy occurs, in my opinion. Look, let's assume, and I think there'll be a lot of talk about it, whether this, let's assume, Rama, that it is in fact, Governor Shumlin has the legal authority. Let's say he has the obligation to start the process. That doesn't mean he has to finish the process. That means he has the obligation to start the process. Let's assume he has the legal authority. But even if Shumlin has the legal authority and the legal right to make this appointment, is it necessary to make the appointment now? And we spoke with Paul Hines about this. Why is he making the appointment now? Is it because Shumlin wishes to limit the power or discretion of the incoming governor to make such an important decision? If this is the motivating factor, then it will force a new governor to rescind Shumlin's appointment should he or she disagree with it. So my question is, why put the state through all this drama when the simplest solution would be to wait for the new governor to make the appointment? Look, like it or not, we're going to have an election in just over a month here. And there will be a new governor. Shumlin's got to recognize this. And he's got to respect the outcome of the election. Trying to thwart a new governor's appointment responsibilities, in my opinion, is being disrespectful to the new governor, whoever it is. But it's also disrespectful to the voters. Now, Shumlin can probably do this if he has the legal authority, but the question is, should he do it? And this has always been the Achilles heel of Governor Shumlin. To his political detriment, you know, Shumlin often forgets that doing something because he can doesn't necessarily mean that he should be doing it. Look, the governor tried to take advantage of a neighbor in a land deal because he could. That doesn't necessarily mean that he should have. He said he waited until after this last election to scrap his single-payer plan because he could. But that doesn't mean it's right. And the governor tried to hide nearly $4,000, a $4,000 expense of a privately chauffeured limousine service. In addition, there was a rental car involved there, too, for a two-day trip to Paris last December. Because he thought he could. But a judge said he shouldn't. And those expenses were released. And now, the governor says he can and will appoint a Vermont Supreme Court justice, even when there's a legitimate question whether he should do it. So the big fuss is this. Governor Shumlin has two choices here. Doing something because he can, or doing what's right and allowing his successor to select the next Vermont Supreme Court justice. This is Free for All Friday. Any subject you want to bring up, it's fair game. The number is 802-244-1777 or toll free at 877-291-8255. Let's go to Rob in North Carolina. Rob, you're on open mic. Good morning.
Hey, Mike, first I want to apologize to your screener. I didn't mean to scream in the phone, but he couldn't hear me, and he kind of took it the personal way, and maybe I sound like I was insulting. I didn't mean to insult him, so I apologize to him, so I don't want to come across that way.
Okay, thanks.
Hillary Clinton in the debate, you know, I sent a tweet to you, not a tweet, I sent a text to you from my, excuse me, Mike. From my Ranger son-in-law, who is for Trump. And he didn't have a chance to see the debate live, so he saw it on YouTube. And he came away saying, Trump, put her down. And so, you know, I think, you know, we know the military, the Rangers in particular, SEALs, Special Forces, they have a more aggressive, you know what I'm saying, right?
Not really, Rob. I'm trying to follow this. But what term do they use? I'm curious on this.
Tough guys, okay? They want action. And his main thing, I've been talking to him, his main thing and my main thing, and I think it's why we can't trust her, is that she deleted 33,000 emails that were supposedly about yoga lessons and the children, grandchildren, and he can't get over it. And I think it's proper because within those emails, we don't know what she was trying to hide. And to me and to him and a lot of people, she did not take the Secretary of State job, give it her full focus. She was back and forth between the foundation, the personal interest, okay, and the interest of the United States. And he's wondering, and some of his buddies are wondering, did she put his and his brothers in any kind of danger? Because I think it's probably pretty obvious at this point, Mike, that some of those sensitive emails have been hacked. And I don't know what's coming out. I don't know what WikiLeaks is coming out with, but it's about the trust factor. He just doesn't trust her.
Yeah, I think that's the problem for Hillary Clinton in general, that she has a trust factor. By the way, Donald Trump has that same trust factor. The military is an interesting thing here because looking at polls of military personnel, they don't necessarily think They don't trust. You're right, absolutely right. They don't trust Hillary Clinton. They probably trust Donald Trump more than they do Hillary Clinton. I have not seen the polls in that. And you've heard me say this, Rob, time and time again. The Benghazi thing, how we responded in Benghazi is important because it signaled to a lot of people that put themselves in harm's way on a day-to-day basis that those in harm's way out there, Benghazi wasn't about politics to them. It was about failing to honor our obligation to protect our citizens when they are in dangerous spots. But worse yet, with Benghazi, it's about our country abandoning Americans in needs, especially in dangerous places and times. And I know some of you have emailed me and say, why are you on Benghazi? Because it is so important to military members. It is so important to those that put themselves in danger. And maybe this is some of the reason for the trust factor. Now, another reason is the general public has a trust factor with Hillary Clinton because she changes her stories. Now, I want to be fair. Donald Trump has a bigger trust problem than Hillary Clinton, but Hillary Clinton has a significant trust problem with the American public. When we come back, it is Free for All Friday. Your phone calls, give us a call. And at 802-244-1777 or toll free at 877-291-8255. Any call, any subject is fair game on Free for All Friday. Well, you got to keep it clean, but Free for All Friday. This is Open Mic. Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith. It's Free for All Friday. Your calls, it's your program. Call in on any subject that you wish to talk about. The number is 802-244-1777 or toll free at 877-291-8255. There's another way to contact us as well. It's our mailbag option. Just email me at msmith@radiovermont.com, and in the subject line just put mailbag. I have a mailbag right here, for example, from Eric of Waterbury. Minter's red herring prohibiting Du Bois from bidding is absurd. Bid is the operative word. They must win the bid to get the contract. It boils down to who can do the work for the best price. Minter is trying to smear Phil Scott in part to divert attention from her bad policy positions, from the sales tax on services to carbon tax. That's from Eric in Waterbury that came in through the mailbag. So let's return to the phones for Free for All Friday. Fred from Newberry, you're up next. Good morning.
Do you think the new president will be picked by the people that have the political acumen that Gary Johnson has?
I lost you, Fred. I'm sorry. Let's go to Jack from Bridport. Jack, you're on Open Mic. Good morning.
Good morning, Mike. Here's a subject I haven't heard brought up. It might have been. But this refugee business, why do they want to bring a bunch of people into this country, which most of them they claim are unvetted, that hate homosexuals? You know, in 10 of the countries that some of these people come from, it's a death penalty for being a homosexual. And if I was in the homosexual community, which I'm not, I would be scared to death of these people.
Interesting analysis, Jack. Thank you for your phone call. We have brought up the refugee issue in that I brought it up in a different way. Now, I will readily admit, I support the refugee program. When I was at Human Services, I was a advocate. When I was Secretary of Human Services, I was an advocate for this program, and I still am. But, to try to, and this is where I really get angry with politicians. Because somebody has a concern about safety or another concern about what impact it will have on the tax rate or other things, they're immediately called racist. And I think that's a cop-out. I think that's the easy way to try to label a person or try to frame the debate. Instead of asking and understanding and trying to address their problems, they're immediately labeled. And that's what I have a problem with the refugee issue here in Vermont. There are some people asking legitimate questions. Now, I happen to support the refugee program, but that doesn't mean we don't pay attention to some legitimate questions that are being asked. And whether it's safety, whether it's impact on local services, Those are legitimate questions. And these people that are asking these questions are not racist. And we need to answer them. Let's go to Ben in Rutland. Ben, it is Free for All Friday. You're on. Good morning.
Good morning. I'm holding your opinion piece about Donald Trump, and I think it's unjustified because let's compare him with Kasich. He spent 18 years in Congress. Why is America so bankrupt? Why is our money so worthless? The trade issue is a big issue, and we know that you couldn't leave your home you'd have to go naked leaving your home if you had clothes made in America. You know, why did these people allow the tax policies to send these companies overseas to send back? And it can't be just that we're saving the Chinese from communism. The Clinton cash is a good example, and the Benghazi issue you just raised. She's posing that she had 70,000 employees. She couldn't deal for 13 hours with Benghazi, and the president was in hiding. Big issues, but trade is there. So you may have to reverse your position on Trump.
Ben, thank you for your phone call, as always. I don't think I'm going to reverse my position on Trump, but what Ben is saying that... I wrote an opinion piece why I'm not supporting Donald Trump, and what I said was that he poses as different people. He claims to be a conservative, but he disagrees with most conservatives on trade. Let's talk about the issue of trade, for example. He's not a free trader. He opposes free trade. And whether you agree or not agree with that issue, conservatives over the past few years have been free traders. Federal spending, he isn't talking about constraining federal spending. And he doesn't talk about constitutional or governmental restraint, a belief that's near and dear to most conservatives. Where I have the most problem with Donald Trump is that he claims that he will provide leadership as the nation's commander-in-chief. And he speaks with much bravado about how he will use the military to exert American power throughout the world. But when he had a chance, when Vietnam was raging, he had two clear and honorable choices. One, to serve in the military, as thousands did, or speak out in a meaningful way to change American policy and push for an end to the war. He chose to do neither. And what we read about Donald Trump during that time is that he obtained a medical deferment and he took, where he was fighting was in the nightclubs of New York, where he partied and womanized. He claims to be compassionate, but he denigrates women, the disabled, even John McCain, a prisoner of war. Not John McCain's policy, which you may or may not disagree with, but the fact that he was a prisoner of war. I got to tell you, I can't get over that. And although he lays claim to the Republican presidential nomination, his loyalty to the party is only recent and is undercut by the past support of Democrats, including, by the way, Hillary Clinton. So you ask me why I don't support. Those are the reasons that I don't support Donald Trump. Let's go to Bill in Barry. Bill, you're on open mic, and Bob from Rutland, thank you for your phone call. Bill from Barry.
I think it's much more important to talk about Benghazi, and my position on this is this. Those people in the service, all of them, there's not a person I ever knew in the service who wouldn't, if they were asked to go save other Americans, wouldn't have gone. If the decision had been made, just like the decision of those firemen and policemen in New York that went into the Twin Towers, they would say, yes, we are going. The people who made the decision not to go weren't people that would even be sticking their necks out. The people who should have been going were the people who would have stuck their necks out, and they would have gone. And that's my position. I think that something is wrong when that has happened.
Thanks, Bill, for your phone call. You know, look, let's take politics right out of this, and maybe you can't, but let's take politics out of this. Why is Benghazi important? Because we ask those that serve in our country to do incredible and sometimes dangerous things. Often in faraway places, isolated. But you know what we must vow to do in return as a country? Is to provide protection and the resources necessary to keep those people safe. In Benghazi, and I know some of you had emailed me and said, why are you harping on this? Because in Benghazi, we failed to do that. A bond was broken between those that serve in dangerous spots and superiors in Washington that are responsible for their safety. And most people out there right now that are in these dangerous spots are saying, will I be protected? Now, many of you want to blame Hillary Clinton. And after all, she was the Secretary of State. And the State Department did drop the ball on protecting that diplomatic compound in Benghazi. But it isn't only Secretary Clinton that dropped the ball on this. The military did as well, because there were numerous calls for help, especially air support, after the diplomatic compound was overrun and there were wave and wave of attacks at the CIA annex. And Pentagon brass equivocated, especially when military assets were needed in that area. And this is dangerous, because morale can plummet when troops begin wondering if the top echelons of their military are more interested in making the politically correct decision, oftentimes in order to protect their own career development or advancement, rather than making the decision that best protects their troops, or in this case, American diplomats and CIA operatives and personnel. That's why Benghazi is important. And I apologize to those people who keep emailing me and saying, get off this subject. It is an important subject, not for politics, but for the people that are in dangerous places. It's Free for All Friday. We're taking all your phone calls on any subject that you wish to bring up, 802-244-1777, or toll free at 877-291-8255. When we come back, more of your phone calls. This is Open Mic. Welcome back to Open Mic. I'm Mike Smith. It's Free for All Friday. We do have phone calls lined up. Let's go to Don in Morrisville. Don, you're on Open Mic. Good morning.
Good morning, Mike. Thanks for taking my call. But I'd really like to have you back up and take a look at Benghazi from another perspective.
Go ahead.
Bob Woodard, among others, has made it quite clear that Obama wanted nothing to do with Libya when Gaddafi was there and was alive. By the same token, Hillary, from the day she took office as Secretary of State, was urging Obama to go in there and take him out. Said she didn't like him, she'd worked with him, and all this nonsense. All of Obama's other advisors said, no, leave it alone. He finally took her word and did it her way, and what did we get? We had more of the Arab Spring, as it's called, well documented by Bob Woodard in Obama's wars as well as elsewhere. I'm sorry. I understand how you feel about Trump, but I'm telling you, that woman is plain evil.
Thanks, Don, for your phone call. And we have to move on because I have to get to some of these phone calls. I want to get them in because we're starting to run out of time. Let's go to Matt in Albany. Matt, you're on open mic.
Hey, Mike. I was just wondering why you think Donald Trump's comments and stance on foreign policy hasn't been talked about as much as other topics, such as, for example, Benghazi or the Miss Universe thing with Trump. I mean, Trump's been making some seriously, potentially dangerous comments on foreign policy recently, such as if a country's not paying as much money as they should be in the EU, they won't be we won't be coming to their defense, or he's even said, like, why can't Japan defend themselves? You talking about decreasing military involvement with protecting Japan.
Yep.
All these comments seem to be, they have a lot of potential negative impact if he did become president, falls through. I'm just wondering why you didn't think those topics aren't being talked about as much as others.
Well, Matt, nice, good questions. I think that those questions are really, we got 2 minutes and 30 seconds, so I got to really roll here. But those are legitimate questions. And by the way, I thought they were the weakest answers in Donald Trump's debate performance in terms of backtracking on what he had said before. These are statements that other countries listen to. And we got to be very careful when you're running for president of the United States. At the same time, I want to be fair, too. I thought Donald Trump in the first 20 minutes of that debate was strong on trade. Now, I don't perhaps agree with him on that, but I thought he made a cogent case and actually had Hillary Clinton on her heels in that. But I think she took over the debate after the first 20 minutes. He seemed to run out of steam. And Matt from Albany, you're absolutely right. He did not handle those questions on foreign policy very articulately or in sort of a comprehensive way in terms of what he was trying to do or say in terms of foreign policy. Hey, I want to thank our guests today. I want to thank all of you. Thank you for your phone calls. These were great phone calls, and thank you very much for them. But I also want to thank our guests today, Alex Apple, WCAX reporter. He was calling in and talking about his Politico magazine article, Why a Republican Might Win Bernie's Home State. And although we did not get to speak with Erin Mansfield, we will have her back in. The topic that she is discussing, the all-payer waiver, is important. And Paul Hines, political editor of 7 Days, our weekly roundup of state politics, and again, all of you. This is Open Mic, and you are listening to locally owned and operated WDEV News Radio on the Friendly Pioneer. Let's say that again, because I rolled right off that word. On the Friendly Pioneer, celebrating its 85th year anniversary this year. 85 years, WDEV News Radio, celebrating the future. WDEV AM 550, broadcasting from Waterbury and Montpelier. 96.1 FM from Warren, 96.5 FM from Barrie, 98.3 FM from Montpelier, and serving the kingdom at 101.9 FM from Island Pond. Of course, we're streaming worldwide at WDEVradio.com. I'm Mike Smith. Thank you for your phone calls. Have a great weekend, and we'll talk again on Tuesday.
The Open Mic Podcast is brought to you by Hickok Boardman, Dennis Ricker, and Brown.
Find us online at hbinsurance.com, and you're always welcome to visit us on Facebook, in Vermont, online, on the phone. Hickok and Boardman Insurance Group. We are here when you need us.